Digital 410 Productions proudly presents What's the Scuttlebutt Podcast with your host, Don Abernathy.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt Podcast, your favorite World War II podcast. And we have gone mobile this week. The At Computer Studios is now mobile. We didn't go too far. We are in Boquilla, Florida, and it's a very special day for us. We are at the wrap party for the Walking Point World War II movie.
Woohoo!
Yeah!
And we have a large crowd here in our mobile studios, but we're going to start things off with the man who put this whole thing together. It was a dream of his. It was a passion project of his. And he made it happen. He crowdfunded it. He wrote it. He sourced the everyone involved. Mr. R.J. Nevins Jr. R.J., how you doing, sir?
Hey, man, I'm doing good. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having me. First, let me say this. I fell into this simply doing what I do, which is trying to get content for my show. I saw that you guys actually, I think it was because of Jeff and the National World War II, the National Pacific World War II Museum. They put a post out on Instagram about this new movie coming out called Walking Point. And so I sent them a message. I said, hey, my name is Don Abernathy. I do a World War II-based podcast. I'd love to have you on the phone to promote your project. And you guys asked for information, and you came back and said, well, where are you at? I said, I'm in Florida. And you said, well, we're actually filming our final scenes in Boquilla. And I said, well, that's my backyard. And so here we are. And you guys shot your final scenes yesterday and today. And you wrapped your project. But RJ, let's start at the beginning a little bit. How did this whole passion project start up for you, and what did it take to get the job done?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to sum up, but I mean, trying to start at the beginning, gosh, it was so long ago. It was probably 7 years ago or so. I've always been a dog guy my entire life. I've had Doberman Pinschers pretty much my entire adult life. And, you know, that kind of threw me into the throes of, you know, trying to research, like, the history of the breed. I'd had to put down one of my Dobermans, Sidney Bell, and that's what kind of led me to do some research on it. So, I mean, it's kind of in her memory it kind of all started. So, you know, doing research, it just kind of led me to, you know, figure out where the first war dog platoon, the first trained war dog platoons actually happened. And, you know, it led me back to Camp Lejeune, mm-hmm. Camp Pendleton, and a wonderful man, Lieutenant William Putney. Who actually, you know, he was one of the lieutenants for one of the first war dog platoons that actually took the dogs into Guam, took them training from Camp Lejeune to Camp Pendleton, and it really just absolutely sparked my interest in it all. And, you know, that's really kind of where it started. And there were other influences. There was a gentleman who was a Navy SEAL. His name was John Tomlinson. 2011, he was killed in combat, and when they put his body to rest, they actually laid it in his high school gym for a while with the flag draped over it, and everybody came to pay their respects to John. And from that, there was a picture that circulated around the internet, an absolutely very emotional, very touching picture that not just kind of touched me, but I'm sure it touched everybody that really saw that picture. And there's actually video of it too, I believe. But his dog, his pet dog, his name was Hawkeye. Hawkeye actually walked into the gym, down the aisle, walked past everybody, looked at a few people, and then went and laid down in front of his casket. And it was a very emotional picture. And you know, that's just, you know, man's best friend. And that was kind of that kind of summed it up all for me, you know.
And so you took a passion and the love that you had, which is the Doberman and history, and you came up with a script and a concept and an idea. And just to fast forward a little bit for the sake of time, whenever you're going to have a project like this, especially when you're going to have a feature that revolves around a non-human main aspect of the movie, I mean, obviously your actors are a key role, but you need a canine for this.
Right.
Without the dog, you have nothing. I mean, it's just another World War II movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm sure at the beginning you had to do some research and figure out, well, who am I going to get to to star in the movie as far as the Doberman goes and the right. and the Canine Companion. So
right.
where did that go, and how did you come up with your answer?
Well, I mean, obviously looking for somebody to portray one of the lead characters in your film, right, who's mm-hmm. not necessarily a human, and it's hard to find a real solid acting reel for a dog, right? I mean, there's only a few. I mean, if you think of Dobermans in the past in film, there's the Doberman Gang, there's, you know, Zeus and Apollo from the old Magnum P.I., there's the new Magnum P.I. dogs, and, you know, so there's very few animal actors out there that fit the role of, you know, a real solid Doberman that would want to play this, that's highly trained and everything. And so I looked around, and honestly, where it all landed, the first person I ever talked to was Ed, and I talked to him about Duke. And, you know, we found Ed and Duke. They were out in Menlo Park, California. I simply reached out to him and asked if he was interested in it. And I think my recollection serves me correctly, but when Ed came back to me, he was basically like, hell yeah. So it's, and from there, of course, you know, I'm skipping about 6 years in,
sure.
in the interim where, you know, we wrote the feature script, feature screenplay, and put it out on the circuit, and it went quite well. It won, you know, awards worldwide, from Australia to United States to, you know, various other places in England and everything. So I knew there was a good story there, right? And from there, obviously budgeting that kind of huge feature is, you know, tens of millions of dollars easily. So we adapted it to a novel and put it out on, self-published it, and it's done quite well. It still does quite well. We give away free copies on, you know, Canine Veterans Day and Memorial Day and stuff like that, and it gets downloaded thousands of times on those days. So I know people enjoy the story. So that idea kind of led to, let's do a short script, and let's do a short film, and let's fundraise for it. And that's when I started to approach Ed and Duke to see if they wanted to be involved in it.
Now, Ed, when you got the request to participate in this project, did you have any past experience in any sort of Hollywood productions or even television shows, anything even remotely similar to working on a project such as this?
My experience and expertise was going to the movies and watching them in a theater, so that's was my extent when RJ reached out, and I told him that. I said, my dog is a working dog, and he's not an actor, and I'm not an actor, and I don't know if he'd be able to do what you're going to ask of him. So that was my first
concern. Ed's being very humble. I'd seen videos. I'd kind of internet stalked Ed for probably about a month and a half, and I saw the videos of Duke working, and I knew Duke had, you know, all the qualities that we would look for in Walking Point. As a matter of fact, I think I even rewrote some of the stuff in the short script to kind of cater towards Duke and his skills. So,
now, as you said, Duke is a working dog. Now, for the sake of our listeners who aren't familiar with Duke and his pure majesty, because he is a stellar, fine canine and a beauty to look at, what occupation is Duke involved in, Ed?
So Duke is a certified narcotic detection dog. He's a single-purpose dog. He's not an apprehension dog. His job is just to find narcotics. I supervise our narcotics enforcement team for our department with all my detectives, and he runs with me. He's my personal dog, and we use him throughout the week when we do our specific missions.
Now, Duke has also found his way into, inadvertently almost, kind of becoming a therapy dog almost when it comes to, I know you did some volunteer service at a children's hospital, is that correct?
Yes, part of when Duke's story is pretty authentic. He's my actual personal dog. I bought him at 8 weeks old as my personal companion, and convinced, or to put it lightly, my chief of police to make him a police officer. So I'm able to bring my buddy, my personal dog, to work with me every day and use him as not only my companion, but to find drugs. And part of the contract between myself and the department, that my first 6 months, he's been on the street, it'll be 3 years this June, but part of the contract between myself and the department was the first 6 months I had to do public relations and community outreach to show the community that, you know, just because he's a Doberman, you know, he's not going to be out attacking people or apprehending people, and he's not, he doesn't have that stigma that, that surrounds the Dobermans of, you know, the Doberman gang, he's going to go out and rob a bank or bite somebody. So I had to do 6 months of PR work, which at the time was not my forte. I hated it. I didn't like public speaking. I didn't go out and like my picture taken. So I begrudgingly said, okay, that's what I need to do to have this dog. And that 6 months turned into now 3 years of me doing PR work on my own and going to children's hospitals and VAs and schools and anywhere that wants us. We never turn down anything that's asked of us. But just to go out and you know, through my Instagram, I'm able to reach a lot of platforms. And part of our stick is, you know, our crazy adventure and our wonderful shenanigans that we get to do. And not only do I love what I do to find dope and put bad guys in jail, but and have my partner find it for me, but that 6 months probationary period to do with something that I didn't want to do turned into 3 years of something that I couldn't see myself doing anything else.
It's wonderful.
And not only has Duke just starred in his first film, but you guys just recently, getting ready to go to publish, they just did a nice story on you and Duke in Working Dog Magazine?
Yes. Karen from Working Dog Magazine just came out. We're going to be on the cover, Duke and I, and there's a wonderful story about how, what basically in a nutshell of what I just talked about, our whole backstory, as well as there's a wonderful article on Walking Point in the same magazine.
So, RJ, now you have the idea for a movie, you have a successful book, you got your dog lined up, but now you need a crew. Now, one of the first people I assume you go to, because behind every great man is a great woman, and you need someone to help with executive production, logistics, social media, and you need a partner to help get this project off the ground, which would be your wife, Chelsea. Now, is this your all's first... Now, I know this isn't your first movie project, but for the sake of our listeners who aren't familiar, who may not be familiar with your background, what were some of the other past projects you guys have worked on?
So we've worked on, we did a short film a while back called Tartarus, The Devil's Basement. Our production company, Black 17, we've been involved in this wonderful documentary, a feature documentary called The Band to Honor with Warren and Annette Hull. And they live in Vegas, and they have been putting together this documentary about the naval band that was on the USS Arizona when Pearl Harbor was attacked, and the band actually went down with the boat. It's a story that not too many people know of, but it's a very beautiful story, and it's also, I believe, one of the first times in history that an entire naval band has ever been killed in action. So we've been involved in that. What other projects have we been involved in? Band to Honor, Tartarus, The Devil's Basement. I mean, we've written several scripts. We have a lot of stuff in our we have a lot of stuff in our back pocket. A lot of feature screenplays, things like that. So
amazingly, Chelsea's quite talkative until you get her behind a microphone.
Isn't that funny?
Now
we're
taking a word out of her.
Isn't that funny? We were also involved in this. We helped produce a feature documentary, another feature documentary called "The Shot in the Dark," which was actually all put together by this wonderful guy in New Jersey named Chris Szczorski. And "A Shot in the Dark" is a story about a young man. He's a blind wrestler in high school,
mm-hmm.
and it's his time while he is chasing becoming the state champion high school wrestler in New Jersey, and some of the trials and tribulations that he goes through. His name is Anthony Ferraro. He is an absolutely wonderful young man who is now competing in the U.S. World Olympic or the Olympics for the United States team. The Special Olympics in the United States team as a wrestler. And judo, I think, is what
judo.
It is. Yeah,
that's
I think
a
it's
fantastic
judo.
Fantastic story.
Yeah.
Now, back to Walking Point. At what point, no pun intended, do you guys... Now, obviously, you have your book. You want to make this into a film project. I assume that, obviously, when it comes to the crowdsourcing and all that, you guys have to get to a budget, a first level of a goal reaching before you start working on the casting. Now, did you guys hire a casting firm, or did you guys do your own casting? Where does the casting start to find a talent? Who headed up that whole project?
So Chelsea headed it up, basically. I mean, there's folks that we had worked with in the past, a few other actors.
I'd say we did it a little backwards.
Oh yeah, we do things backwards.
We actually attended Austin Revolution Film Fest, which is about the time we were starting Walking Point back in the fall of 2018. And they had a workshop on crowdfunding and social media. Oh, Duke. they point blank said, you need to cast it first, mm-hmm. and then do your crowdfunding. You need to get your people on board, and then you'll get your crowdfunding. And we did it completely backwards. And we were like kind of in a moment where we weren't sure if that was going to work the way that we did it. And it was a little bit of a panic, but we just kind of went for it. And we talked about it, and this is his passion project. I watched him many a nights for many years writing this, and I watched him write it and was nowhere involved,
sure.
except for just sleeping in the bed next to him writing.
But you know, the crowdfunding piece, quite honestly, was probably one of the easiest parts of the entire story.
I beg to differ.
There were people that were willing to donate their hard-earned money to the project, and without anything in return. And you know, there's so many other folks that just bring it to fruition as well. But
you have to understand, this is not our main job. We both have executive day jobs, and mm-hmm. this is just a passion of ours that we do on the side. So we basically are working 5 full-time jobs. It's what it feels like. But we work really well together, and this was passion, and it became my passion because it was such an important story to tell, and it was, you know, everything that you love, America and dogs and mm-hmm. patriotism and you know, when we started the whole project and we decided to make a, you know, proof of concept film, essentially, so that we could get the story told eventually, this was the way to do it. So,
you know, as far as the casting piece of it, you know, a gentleman, I know you're going to talk to him later, I believe, Lou Wegner.
Mm-hmm.
So, Lou, I believe, read the feature script probably 6 or 7 years ago.
Sure.
And Lou is heavily involved in animal advocacy, and he actually has this wonderful nonprofit called Kids Against Animal Cruelty. It's a nationwide thing. It's a beautiful thing that he does. And from the moment that I saw Lou, and I knew he was a young actor at the time, I think Lou was probably 14 or 15, I think. I can't even recall. I sent him the script. He loved it. I talked to his mother and everything, and surprisingly, full circle, Lou and his production company, Castle Bay, is and Lou plays our lead. Lou is our Private Markle. So,
casting,
it's pretty interesting.
Casting was not something that was very easy for this, but I can tell you one of the most special things about casting this project, and we've cast other projects, and I always said, I'll never do it again. I'll hire a casting manager that will take care of it all, because it's such a huge, huge job and it's such an important job. But we knew what we were looking for, and we just decided to do it ourselves. And I can tell you the most special thing about it is when we put this out to cast it, we told people what the premise was. We told them to, you know, let us know if they were military or veterans or connected in any way, because it was really important to us that our cast and our crew were that had that background, they had that knowledge, and that we involved those types of people. And I can't tell you the floods and floods and floods of applicants, thousands have come, thousands, and every single one of them, almost without a doubt, had long, long emails. And we've cast other things. You don't get emails with your casting. This one had email upon email about how much this meant to them, how this was a story that needed to be told, how dogs were their life. And just reading through these emails, it was very touching how important it was to everybody, and we knew we had something really special at that point.
Each one of the actors earned their way. There's no doubt
about
it. There was so much competition. I guess in the grand scheme of things, we had over probably 500-600 people audition for the various roles. You know, people were sending us auditions when we didn't even ask for auditions, just doing reads and monologues and things like that. So yeah, it was tough, but I certainly think we made the right decisions with Lou and Cliff and Josiah and Liza,
Duke, Ian.
Ian, yeah.
Yeah.
There's just a lot
talent.
Of good talent out there that needs to be discovered.
Well, one of the other things you kind of had going against you, if you will, or working uphill, not only are you doing an independent film, you're crowdsourcing it, but you're doing a period piece. And so now you're going to need, one, uniforms, aircraft uniforms. You're going to need a consultant, and you're going to need to have somebody to rely on to fill in the blanks, because as a reenactor, and the people who, a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are reenactors, and I'll tell you, one of the biggest things that we are dicks about is authenticity. And so where did you proceed to go down that road to figure out, where can I get some help with this aspect of the story?
Yeah, so, you know, right before Chelsea and I had decided to pursue making a short film from Walking Point, we had visited in Fredericksburg, Texas, the National Museum of the Pacific War, and they have a reenactment that I believe they do 6, 7, 8 months out of the year, once a month throughout the weekend. They run it twice a day on that set weekend. And so Chelsea and I went to go see it, and it was absolutely phenomenal to watch the reenactments that they did. And so afterwards, you know, it was kind of funny. Chelsea and I just looked at each other, and we knew exactly. I knew what she was thinking. She knew what I was thinking. And I was like, let's go talk to this guy who runs this, who puts this all together, who handles the 150 volunteers that come and do this. And so we met up with Jeff Copsetta, who is the historian for their Living History program. And from there, we just started talking about Walking Point, and he became one of our biggest champions of the project. He actually has a role in the project as well. He plays Andy Boyle. And man, let me tell you, it was fate when we decided to walk down there and just say, hey, I'm RJ. Hey, I'm Chelsea. And he said, hey, I'm Jeff. And it was just kind of, from there, it just kind of snowballed.
Well, as someone who does reenacting and who specializes in the PTO myself, because I've seen many of videos and many of the photos shot out at your facility, and at what point, when you got hooked up and involved in the film, did you guys know that, well, you pretty much have a soundstage for all intents and purposes out behind your museum, and that would be an adequate place to do some of the scenes there?
Yeah, like RJ told me before, the production value of the Pacific Combat Zone at the National Museum of the Pacific War is just almost priceless, and I didn't quite understand what he meant by that until we started filming there. And it's not a very large area, mm-hmm. but he made it large. The amount of scenes that he filmed there, the amount of footage that was taken from there is, I'm there 40, 50, 60 hours a week sometimes. It's my backyard. It's my office. And seeing what he did to it, how he transformed it, was unbelievable. The viewers won't, I mean, some of the people who know that place very well won't recognize it in the film. He really, his foresight and his what was in his mind, To see it happen right there, right behind my office, was just incredible. What an incredible experience to be a part of it.
Now, when he came to you, and you were definitely interested, I'm sure, was there any work to be done on your part to get the museum to be willing to do this? Or were they on board from the word jump? I mean, one, obviously, the Museum of the Pacific War, obviously, they focus on the United States Marine Corps, with the exception of maybe a half of a scene in the HBO Pacific, war dogs really aren't covered at great lengths, at least in feature films. Were they just, yeah, do it, or did it take a little more coaxing to allow them to allow production on your property?
I love it.
Not well, to put you in a hard spot.
No, not at all. So first, I do want to mention that we focus on all five branches that had such a pivotal role in the Pacific War. There is a part of the museum that focuses on war dogs and how important they were. But you're right; it is very overshadowed, and I didn't realize how overshadowed it was till I met RJ and Chelsea. I did research till my eyes were bleeding for the sake of this. But to answer your question, there's so many stories that need to be told, mm-hmm. From World War II. And that's what I try to do in my everyday job. I'm not a reenactor. Living history is very different. We try to tell an entire story of an entire generation when people come to see our museum. To reenact something that happened in history could never be done perfectly.
No.
But we do have that ability, that artistic license in to be living history actors, to tell a story, to evoke emotion. And my colleagues and my superiors saw the passion that I had for this project. It was a story that needed to be told. And like I mentioned before, where else can we do this but the National Museum of the Pacific War, that focuses on that struggle in an unbiased way from the American and Japanese side, and what it really took to do what we did in such a short amount of time, how the entire country came together to accomplish what we did in the Pacific. Nothing parallels that.
Well, not only are you a not only would you be a great consultant because, you know, you do work at the National Museum of the Pacific War, but you yourself are, in fact, a Marine. You did serve. I mean,
give this man some ground.
So I was a soldier in the Army?
Really? Well, see, you know, that's
from
the best
2001
part.
To 2005?
Well, see, you know, that's the best part about podcasting is I can edit all that shit out.
That's beautiful, because this is a giant pile of shit, what you just said.
Well, to be fair to me, I thought I heard, like, four people refer to you being a Marine today.
Yeah, there was a few former Marines on set today that I was... razzing,
okay,
to not judge me by wearing a Marine Corps uniform today.
Well, at no point today did I hear the phrase "dog face" thrown around, so I wasn't, you know, aware that you're in the Army.
So, and if you'll allow me, and you don't edit this out,
sure.
Today marks the 15th anniversary. It's all over my social media, and I'd love to give a shout out to some former colleagues of mine. Fox Troop 9th Cavalry Regiment, 15 years ago today, took a picture when we first pushed up into Baghdad. And we all, 15 years, man.
Time flies, man.
It was 15 minutes ago in my mind. And that's what really helped me harness the energy that I could try to give RJ and Chelsea. I'm not a consultant. I'm not a historian. I'm a former soldier. And I'm the living history coordinator at the most incredible museum in the country. I just wanted to be a part of this.
Sure.
Because the greatest generation, as we all know, is slipping past us. And like I said before, there are so many stories that needs to be told. And it brings us all, it's full circle. The mission statement at the National Museum of the Pacific War is to inspire our youth by honoring our heroes. And... I have a short amount of time left where I can go up to one of these heroes and say, is that how it was done?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like to think about the day that they're no longer with us, but I do realize the responsibility that we have on our shoulders for all of those who are passionate about this time period, that when they're no longer here, that our youth will look up to us. So we got to get it right. We have to. It can't be forgotten, and it has to be honored. And that's what we do. That's what RJ wanted to do, and I just wanted to be a small part of it.
Yeah, we're definitely fighting the clock. Now, Ed inadvertently took Duke and wandered off, but he wandered off too soon because I have more questions for Ed. We weren't done with Ed.
Hey, Brandon, we can fly him back in.
Yep. A small room so we can make it all work. So, we're going to fast forward a little bit here. So now... you got your funding, you got your casting, you got your consultant, you got your location. And so now we're going to go to, real quick, what was your shoot schedule like?
So our shoot schedule was, I worked really hard with our director of photography, Duncan Johnson, and several other folks that he works with on a daily basis, and some people I've worked with before in the past that put together a really awesome crew. We were able to get 4 days in Fredericksburg, Texas, two of those at the National Museum of the Pacific War, two more of them in various locations, housing locations actually in Fredericksburg. And then we just finished wrapping 2 days here in Bokelia at a wonderful location that we happened to come upon that is managed by a Marine, a former Marine, Pete. And we reached out to Pete, who works at a group called Palmco. And through those guys, we were able to hook up with an owner of a large coconut grove, about a 50-acre coconut grove, who has ties to the entertainment industry in her past as well. And after talking to her, she was very happy to let us come down here and use her land and finish shooting those 2 days here. And that's been kind of an overarching theme of this entire project. There's been so much just graciousness and people donating their time and people donating their resources. Most of our food in Fredericksburg were donated by local museums. Some of our housing was donated by local Airbnbs and, I'm sorry, yeah, restaurants. A lot of our food were donated by local restaurants in Fredericksburg, and as well as some of the housing and things like that. Everybody was very happy. I think actually when Duke and Ed were walking around in town, people would say, oh, aren't you guys here for that film Walking Point? So it was just, I don't know. Fredericksburg embraced it. Everybody in Bokelia has embraced it. And we were very happy to have an uncontrolled environment shooting 6 days outside. And we didn't have to fight off any rain.
That in itself is
from a production that means a lot.
Miracle.
Yes.
Now, Ed, first day of shooting, obviously, as you said, you know, Duke is a working dog. You yourself as a police officer. This is all new to both of you. Mm-hmm. Unlike other actors, yes, you're in control of Duke, but Duke is in control of Duke.
Yes.
Whereas if you're an actor, all that pressure falls on you to perform, whereas the pressure falls on you to get him to perform in a situation that he's not ever done before.
Absolutely.
Day one, first shoot, you're driving into the location. What was going through your head?
Please don't embarrass me. Please don't embarrass me. RJ put a lot of trust, RJ and Chelsea put a lot of trust in me that I can honestly say I trust my dog 100% to do his job and everything else that entails. But, you know, as in anything, if you're walking in the door and you have no experience and somebody has, you know, the faith in you to say, yeah, we want you. Yeah, you don't want to screw it up. You don't want to trip over. You want to do your best. You know, I have faith in Duke has the ability to do what I tell him to do. But, yeah, I was scared shitless.
Sure.
I did not want to let RJ down because, you know, reading the book and researching what he did and you know, pivotal part of the film, I did not want to screw up this project that's his heart and soul.
Well, you know, it's one thing to teach a dog to perform on command and to do such something as, you know, finding narcotics and things like that. But when it comes to shooting a movie and acting, it's performing that same command over and over and over without getting anxiety, without, you know, them showing tired or just saying to hell with it, I'm not going to obey anymore. Were you shocked at how well he did as far as the long hours and redoing the same thing over and over again on command?
I was not shocked. That's why we casted him.